The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. We're going to talk to Dobek Peyton in just a moment, the telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis, all about a huge deal that is being proposed. And it's not necessarily huge in monetary terms. It's probably worth about 15 billion rand. But it's going to be huge from a signaling point of view in terms of what government is prepared to and not prepared to do with state-owned assets. Government, via the Public Investment Corporation and the Department of Communications, controls Telkom. Today, MTN has put in a bid for Telkom, said, well, hasn't actually put a price on the table, but it said, we're in negotiations, we're beginning to talk. Telkom has bolstered its board with some very high-level players and let the games begin. But fully expect the regulators, the unions, and expect the RET Brigade, what are they called, the Radical Economic Transgression Brigade, Brigade, those guys, to step into the breach here as well and cause havoc at the ANC policy conference in a couple of weeks' time. Just when you thought government statements, by the way, couldn't get any balmier. After various utterances from Becky Cele on the spate of tavern murders, we've seen the Labour minister saying government would create 2 million jobs by the next election, but he conceded he had no idea how it would happen. Yesterday, somebody else said something quite balmy, but today's takes the cake. The president saying government is considering a proposal. I think it comes from the desk of or the office of the energy minister, Gwede Mantashe, to create a second state-owned Eskom to compete with Eskom. Eskom's not working. So government wants to create another state-owned power utility as a competitor. And it's provoked predictable outrage, the best of which comes from the venture capitalist Michael Jordan, who says, well, okay, how about a second state-owned railway company, a second state-owned port operator, a second home affairs, a second driver's license department? If you're going to do a second Eskom, can't you do second versions of all of those sorts of things? Or could you save everybody an awful lot of time, money, energy, and frustration and simply let people who know what they're doing take them over and run them properly? Just a thought.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Play the Brutal Biz Quiz and our Friday file, we look at luxury. You can buy very expensive luxury goods for less than they cost in the shops. If you've always had a fancy for luxury things, what is it? Would you like pens? Do you have a thing for handbags, for shoes, Miss Tabi? What do you like? What are you prepared to buy secondhand? Would you buy somebody's secondhand Chanel boots? They've only been worn once with a faint whiff of toe jam, but I mean, would you buy half price, George? I'm cheap enough, but they'd still be too expensive. Telkom looking to buy El Telkom on the market, it would seem. MTN has made a pitch for Telkom, both under cautionary early stage talks. Today, all of the telecommunications shares were up. Telkom by 25% by the close. Both MTN and Vodacom were up strongly as well. The market clearly loves the deal, but it's a complicated transaction to get over the line. Telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis, Dobek Peyton, on the line to us from Midrand. Is it even feasible in your wildest imagination that a deal like this could happen, Dobek?
It could, yeah. I mean, there's nothing really to work against it, obviously within a number of constraints. So it would be very closely looked at both from the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal subsequently, and then also from ICASA, the Market Regulatory Authority, because it would effectively merge two out of the four largest operators we have, or maybe two out of the five largest operators we have in the market in South Africa. So a lot of caution would need to be exercised by the competition authorities to ensure that it didn't then subsequently become an anti-competitive development in the market. But we have seen a precedence of this on a smaller scale already, and one that's concluded, and that was CIVH acquiring Vumatel, also owns the dark fiber Africa, the fiber optic infrastructure operator in South Africa. So there are quite a few obligations and constraints put in place in order to ensure that there will be no anti-competitive behavior. And we now also have Vodacom in advanced discussions, in fact, with CIVH and looking at creating an infrastructure, superstructure, super company, new InfraCo, combining various fiber assets, telecommunications infrastructure assets into a single company. And that is also going to now be is being reviewed by the competition authorities in order to determine whether it's not an anti-competitive move. We expect that it will be sanctioned. They will receive the blessing of the authorities to create this new InfraCo. But again, there will be, I think, quite a few constraints written into a permission of that nature.
Is it a deal that needs to be done? I mean, does South Africa's telecom sector need consolidation? We always complain that prices are too high, there's not enough competition. This takes competition out of the market rather than adds to a competitive environment. From your perspective, is it necessary?
Yes. Well, the perspective in general is yes. It also, to an extent, plays into the government's aim of creating greater infrastructure sharing in South Africa. So, at infrastructure level, the products that are being sold are effectively basic connectivity links, let's say fiber optic links, whether they are national or local in the metro or access the last mile. These products are becoming commoditized all the time. They have been for quite a while, which means the money that you can make on that in the profit is decreasing, and you need greater to be able to sell greater quantities as an operator to continue operating efficiently. So and South Africa is not really that big of a market at the end of the day. So it does make sense to have a fewer infrastructure operators, not a single one. We would have possibly two bigger ones and some smaller infrastructure operators at different levels of infrastructure in the country. But it could also, depending how that market is regulated, it could then also present greater opportunities to retail service providers to use that infrastructure, which could be delivered more efficiently, perhaps at a more competitive price than it is now. And so at an infrastructure level, yes, I think it does make sense to have some consolidation at this stage. We are seeing it in the fiber to the home, fiber to the business market, the last mile, has been taking place on a much smaller scale for a year to 2 years now.
Okay.
But there will be, as long as we retain a healthy competition at the retail level.
Sure. I mean, when we look at it, and Telkom is controlled by government via the Department of Communications and a stake held by the PIC. Together, they make up more than 50% of the shareholders. This is going to test government's willingness to do something quite tough, and that's to sell state-owned assets, to realize the value they've got in businesses in order to raise money for the fiscus. It's tiny. It's about, 15 billion rand or whatever. It's not a huge amount of money. This isn't going to make a huge difference to Eskom's debt level or anybody else's, but it's an important signal, I suppose, in terms of government's willingness to act in the real world.
Correct. So, I suppose there are two aspects to it. One is the PIC stake, so it has a 14% stake in Telkom. It also has a significant 26% stake in MTN. And if a super company were created, MTN/Telkom, group, then PIC likely would retain a shareholding in that company, which may not necessarily be insignificant. It could be quite substantial. So the government could still have an interest indirectly through PIC in a new structure of that nature. I think the second point is that we have seen moves from the government, these overtures, that it is beginning to change its ideological outlook on life a little bit. And prepared to start introducing a greater degree of privacy and private enterprise and privatization into state-owned enterprises, because to in many instances the government has proved itself to actually not be able to run these companies, enterprises efficiently, in fact, to the detriment of the South African public.
And they're taking it very seriously. I mean, Telkom and MTN both issuing statements this morning disclosing that they are in talks. Telkom is bolstering its board. It's added several new members, including a senior deal maker, the ex-corporate investment bank boss from Nedbank, Brian Kennedy, as well as a former MTN South Africa chief executive in Mteto Nyati. Those appointments today are certainly not accidental appointments. And it does show that this is everyone's taking this potential deal, this likely deal, very seriously indeed.
Correct. Yeah, I suppose that is part of the thinking certain individuals like Mteto Nyati, who is a former MTN person, are being brought into onto the Telkom board, perhaps to start working on taking this process further and smoothing the way for a merger between the two companies. So I think from the looks of it, it's still very initial stages, but I think from the looks of it, it looks like it's a little bit more serious as far as those initial discussions are concerned than it was the last time round, or maybe even the last two times round.
Thank you to Dobek Pater, the telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis this evening. The big story today, MTN keen to buy Telkom. Share price of Telkom up 25% on the day. We also saw big moves in Vodacom and also in MTN. Does this mean that Vodacom is going to have a go? I wonder. Could another telecoms player from somewhere else have a go? I wonder. The signal's been sent that Telkom could be up for sale. Is it time for a bidding war, or is this a deal that goes through? I wonder what your thought on that one is.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
There is something called the Financial Action Task Force. It is headquartered in Paris. It is an intergovernmental body. And it sets standards internationally for combating illicit financial activity. And it gave South Africa 18 months, and that was about 16 months ago, to address some very specific shortcomings in its ability to prevent financial crimes. And in October 2021, they published an evaluation report, and the evaluation report said South Africa's not doing enough. And it turns out we're in actually very serious danger of being added to what's called a grey list of countries deemed as having inefficient measures to place combat and to combat money laundering and terrorist financing. And it could mean that on your next trip to Beijing, Brisbane or Bonn, you won't be allowed to use your credit card. That's how serious. David Buckham is the founder and chief executive of Monocle Solutions. He also wrote a fabulous book called The End of Money. But David, how serious a risk is this to South Africa and its ability to transact with the rest of the world?
Hi, Bruce. It's a serious risk in the immediate future and long term. So the countries that are on the list are countries that you wouldn't normally associate with us, I would say. And the risk is that money laundering and counter-financing of terrorism laws came about because of the war on drugs initially in 1989, and then 2001, they got a really elevated front and center because of the September 11th attacks, which was financed by funds in the derivatives market. So the thinking was in Western countries to shut down these channels of financing through anti-money laundering and counter-financing of terrorism. So South Africa is one of those countries that has a sophisticated financial center, which is perfect, but it has lots of loose ends. So it's a real danger to the world and to us. So it's serious enough, I think, to happen.
It's serious enough to happen, and I don't think this is a move that the Financial Action Task Force would take lightly. The National Treasury seems to think that it can kick the can down the road on this thing, and I've got no doubt that they can. But it's, I mean, the thing is, there were 10 assessors that came from the Financial Action Task Force. They came from the IMF. They came from the anti-money laundering group in Eastern and Southern Africa. And they've had a good look at us. And I suppose what's more, perhaps more alarming than the fact that we could be put on this grey list is the fact that our financial controls are inadequate, insufficient. And we wonder how the Guptas and others allegedly got money out of the country. We simply don't have the mechanisms, adequate enough mechanisms to stop.
Yes, I mean, the findings show that law enforcement is inadequate and financed and understaffed, that unsophisticated, and that we don't have the adequate laws in place. And we were slow on state capture prosecutions, and we're slow on prosecutions, and that we characterize violent political acts as not as terrorist acts, which slows down the prosecution thereof. So we don't meet the standards on a number of fronts. And whilst we can pass some laws quickly, potentially, we certainly, it's going to take a bit longer to solve one of the many problems in South Africa. The concern is to
shut us out. And we've lost him. David Buckham, I think your point is well made. Thank you. Founder and Chief Executive at Monocle Solutions, David Buckham this evening. Sorry about the cell phones. It's that time of day. So it's interesting, this Financial Action Task Force. I don't anticipate that we're going to go to hell in a handbasket on this particular issue. I guess we'll get a free pass. And National Treasury knows exactly how serious it is. National Treasury is working really hard on this, but it can't do everything. There is a process in government which needs to be acted upon, and we know that that can be tough from time to time.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, China's economy contracted sharply in the second quarter of this year. Widespread coronavirus lockdowns hitting business and consumers. And we saw GDP fall by 2.6% in the 3 months to the end of June. That comes as the country continues to pursue its zero COVID policy. And it's interesting, Gary McNamara, who's a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, how that was reflected very strongly in today's update from Richemont.
Absolutely, Bruce. And I don't think any of us can try and make sense of what the Chinese COVID policy is. But it was actually quite a pleasant surprise, the Richemont trading update. It was for the first quarter this year. And it was surprisingly positive. Obviously, mainland China was quite negative, but Europe quite a lot stronger with the recovery in the tourism sector there. And bearing in mind, this is also a company that there's quite a strong influence from Rupert the Bear, Johann Rupert, and he's known as Rupert the Bear. He can be quite negative, and at the last set of results for the full year last year were quite negative, and he was obviously forecasting quite a lot of negative news going forward. So the analysts had obviously anticipated some quite bad news, but the results actually came in a lot better than expected.
I think we should take, without antagonizing the great Johann Rupert, we should take his mood as a counter-cyclical indicator, because so often he gets so negative, and then the company produces spectacular results, because I wonder if they just underestimate the world's desire for bling and shiny things.
Absolutely, Bruce, and it's much more resilient. We've seen it in a number of sectors, particularly with the recovery from COVID. The earnings from the European sector was a much better recovery. Mainland China was disappointed, but that was expected. But the group sales were 12% up in constant currency, and that was certainly not forecast at the full year results. And a sales growth sales of 5.3 billion euros, which is massive relative to expectations, 5% above. So the market quite liked it. I was surprised that the share was actually down on the day, but it has recovered from those quite negative forecasts of a couple of months ago.
And then what do you make of the MTN pitch for Telkom? It's certainly a deal that the market likes, I think, on virtually every front.
Absolutely. The details aren't out yet. They just say it's going to be potentially a cash and share offer. And it's a type of sector where the market really likes critical mass, the so-called guerrilla game. The bigger you are, the more money you make. It's about a volume. Margins generally have been under pressure in this space for a long time. So the bigger you can get, taking out Telkom via MTN would actually be quite a big coup for them. And they'll just get much more critical mass from that part. So the market quite liked it. MTN was up 5% on the day. Details not clear. The one probably negative is how much government's going to remain as shareholder. We don't necessarily want government as shareholders in some of our businesses, but those details are still to be ironed out. But the market quite liked the amount.
All of this is happening against the backdrop of a looming global recession. We saw the China growth number. We see America likely to have to raise interest rates harder and faster than ever anticipated after this week's shock inflation number of 9.1%. Global recession certainly seems to be coming. There's something called the Financial Conditions Index out of Goldman Sachs. It looks at the United States credit spreads. They look at mortgage rates. They look at equity prices and a broad index. And that has rocketed by 300 basis points this year. And it's kind of similar to what happened during the COVID shock of March 2020 and the global financial crisis of 2008. And it's leading a lot of people to say, hold on a second. All of the sort of market indicators are suggesting we are driving at 120 kilometers an hour, and there's not going to be enough time to put on brakes before we hit a wall.
Yes, Bruce, it's a difficult one because the market is grappling with this uncertainty. As you say, the 9.1 inflation print, the interest rate moves in America, they're talking potentially a 1% basis points move later this month. And, you know, we've got full employment pretty much in America, so it's still going quite well. Consumer spending seems to be holding up quite well. But the world is worried about the so-called recession risk that comes through. But having said that, you've also got some of these commodities that have been quite high on inflation. Food we've seen rolling over on some of the basic things internationally. Oil is off from its peak from 120, around 100 today. So I do believe inflation will start rolling over internationally because it does have a bit of a base effect. And hopefully that will allow the Fed to be less aggressive on the interest rates, maybe not at this meeting, but going forward. And I think the market will take comfort from that. But at the moment, the market doesn't really know which way to move at the moment. Sometimes it's quite positive. They see some positive announcements. And other times, like this week, we're probably about 6% off over the week. So it's been quite a bloody week from that point of view. But the market is very unsure how this recession and interest rates are going to play out over the next 6 to 12 months.
I know you didn't enjoy the week, but to call it a bloody week is rude. No need to swear, Gary McNamara. It was a bloody week. Thank you, Gary McNamara, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth this evening.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show, and I am Bruce Whitfield, and in the next hour, we'll bring you the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been, including an extract from the discussion we had with Julia last night, Super Saver Julia. If you missed it, you'll get it on The Best Bits, and if you want to hear all of it, you can download our podcast, as you should be doing every day. You should be subscribing. It's free. Give away things for free because we're good that way. You can catch up with The Money Show each and every single day, no matter where you are, as long as you have a signal, of course. On the next Money Show, Lawson Naidu, Executive Secretary at the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, CASAC, joins us as our guest on Other People's Money. It's going to be really interesting to get his perspective on money. And journalist and author Nick Dahl will take us through his latest book, Spoilt Ballots, Elections That Shaped South Africa from Shaka to Cyril. He's got some wonderful insights, has Nick Dahl, who has got a really cheeky writing style. And it's a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous book. And looking forward to sharing parts of that book with you on the next Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Do you like expensive, pretty things? Do you like ring, bling, and shiny things? Big brand watches, designer clothes, beautiful leather goods made with the finest grain leathers that the world has got to offer. Fancy pens. I took a walk the other day down New Bond Street in London. It's De Beers, I think it's New Bond Street. I took a walk down Jermyn Street, which is just off Savile Row. It's Piccadilly sort of side, and the shirt makers are there. Savile Row is the place of the suits. And Dunhill was over there. And all the world's big brands are in this incredibly wealthy part of London. And I wonder whether you buy luxury goods. Some people save up for luxury goods. Some people deliberately have a strategy of buying certain lines of pens, for example, want to buy fancy watches. Would you like the stuff as much if you got it second hand? I think I'd like it a lot more. Because surely a Cartier is a Cartier is a Cartier. I mean, it, you know, Does it matter that it's a year or two or five old, as long as it's in good condition when you get it? Michael Zaharif is the founder of Luxity. And Michael, you have built a business out of selling pre-loved or second-hand luxury goods. Where did it all start?
Hi, Bruce, and thanks for having me on the show. The business started a while back when we realized there was a problem. When one of our close friends who was very involved in luxury goods, a luxury collector, if you have it, decided to sell some of our items and found the process really scary in South Africa, quite tedious, using the online platforms and very unsafe. So we thought, you know, could we do it better by building a safe community online or platform where people could buy luxury goods safely and securely and knowing that they were authentic?
Okay, so you set up this portal. What sort of experience did you have? I mean, are you from the luxury goods space? Are you a technologist? Where do you fit in?
So originally, myself and my co-founder, we have a online digital agency called Be Online. It's still running today. So we came from a digital background, knowing online marketing as well as e-commerce. And that was the first step into this world of luxury for us.
And the world of luxury, what enticed you into it?
It was just an opportunity. We've always been entrepreneurs at heart. Originally, we began with our digital agency, just trying to replace our waiters' salaries while we were studying. And from there, we had a couple forays into, trying to do some apps, trying to do a couple of different industry things. And when she came to us with this problem, we thought, yes, sure, we don't know much about luxury goods. You know, we weren't lucky enough to make enough money to afford any at that stage. But we were really interested in this problem solution mentality. So we set up the e-commerce platform. We represented ourselves as a legitimate source, you know, in a very corporate manner that would create trust amongst the consumers. And from there, it just took off like wildfire.
How do you verify, one, the authenticity of the goods that you're buying, because there are a lot of fakes and many of them are very good fakes? And also, how do you trust the sources of your products? Because with the rates of theft in South Africa, for example, it's kind of hard to wonder where some of the stuff might come from sometimes.
No, exactly. And I think it's actually, to answer your second question first, it's definitely verifying the source is becoming more and more important. When we began, people didn't, like the thieves wouldn't really know that these things had value. So if you did steal someone's luxury handbag, because there wasn't a big market for it, it would be very difficult for you to resell that worthwhile. So they weren't really a target. But now as the market is developing, we're seeing luxury handbags, shoes, even clothing being more and more a target of thieves because they're realizing the value that there is for these items on the secondhand market. As far as authentication goes, we have become expert authenticators. We're the only company in South Africa that hand authenticates all of our items by ourselves. And we have many, many, many years of knowledge on the specific brands, the trademarks of how the brand will put items together. And on top of that, we've developed some specific company proprietary technologies to authenticate, where we examine some bags at a microscopic level to see the number of threads, the material at a microscopic level to justify if it's a fake or not. Remember, the counterfeiters are generally looking not to fake the authentic, not to fool the authenticators, but rather to fool the everyday consumer. So they only fake bags and clothing, etc., to a certain level. In the watch industry, it's much, much, much more. The fakes are much more convincing, but in the handbag and other categories, they're still much easier to pick up a fake.
Okay, that's useful to know. And you've got an astonishing array of goods. I mean, do people generally sell their stuff when they get sick of it, when they fall on hard times? Do you buy stuff from deceased estates? Where is your primary source of raw materials?
Yeah, I think something that people find interesting all the time is that 100% of our items are stocked locally from private individuals. And to be honest, the biggest or the most volume of items come from people making more space in their closet. So these are ladies, they're going to Dubai or Paris, and they realize, you know, I want to buy some new items, but I have no space left in my closet. So let me take 20, 30 bags, go give it to Luxity, I make some money out of it, and I'll have space in my closet. So that would be the main reason people sell, or like the highest volume of stock. But at the same time, there's an array of reasons. You know, sometimes it's a girlfriend who got a nice gift and now she's broken up. She wants to make a bit of money. Sometimes it's people going on to hard times. Sometimes it can even be people immigrating and they don't want to carry all the items with them. So there's a variety of reasons South Africans sell their luxury goods.
And I get things like watches and jewelry, the accessory sort of stuff. But you've got secondhand shoes and boots. And yes, they're Bally shoes. I mean, yes, very expensive, beautiful Swiss-made shoes. And there's a big market for, you know, clothes that have been worn seldom. Yeah, you can dry clean those. But shoes, there is a market for secondhand shoes.
Well, yeah, there definitely is. And it's a huge market. I think with shoes, many people, specifically with the higher end shoes, they won't wear them every day. So they might buy a specific shoe that matches a dress or a specific shoe for an occasion. So they'll wear it once or twice maybe, and then it will sit in their closet. So it's they're in very, very good condition generally, maybe worn once or twice for the most part. And at the end of the day, you can also clean a shoe, which of course we do. We have professionally clean all of our items, including clothing. And clothing is actually, interestingly, a category we only entered recently because we also thought people would, there'd be a higher stigma towards clothing, like you assume about shoes. But it's actually the fastest growing category we've ever added to Snack City, very interestingly.
No, absolutely. And I mean, there's a fabulous business in the US, and I was listening to Guy Raz on How I Built This, and he was interviewing the founders of Rent the Runway. And these two women started this business probably about 10 years ago, going directly to designers and buying designer garments and renting them out at, you know, about a fifth of what it would cost to buy them, on the basis that particularly women in New York were not going to be seen in the same outfit twice. So why would you buy it when you could rent it for a fraction of what it would cost, take it back, get it cleaned, and then rent another outfit the next time you wanted to go out? And I suppose on that basis, the idea of especially the great brands, a lot of the stuff is looked after really well and is in great condition. You've got physical outlets. You're in Nelson Mandela Square. You're in the Cape Quarter in Cape Town. You're in Menden Main in Pretoria. And I suppose that also gives a little bit of assurance for people to actually kick the tires, so to speak, of used luxury goods versus taking the chance of going online and wondering about the returns policies and all of that sort of stuff.
Yes, exactly. We've opened physical stores back in 2017. We started with Melrose Arch and have expanded that store in Nelson Mandela Square. And that was a specific move we made because we wanted to establish this trust further, you know, and remove the stigma. We were actually the first omni-channel retailer. And that means a store that's both online and physical locations shortly after Yuppiechef followed. The reality is that on the case of the renting, the great thing about what we're doing in selling pre-owned and what we're seeing a lot of customers uptake these days is they'll buy a bag or an item and they'll wear it for 6 months, 7 months maybe, and then they'll come back to us and resell that bag to buy the next one. So in effect, they're renting it. And for those customers, if you buy a bag from us and you want to sell it back, we guarantee you 70% return on your original purchase price at minimum. So at the end of the day, you're essentially renting that bag for in, you know, as long as you'd like for 30% of the retail price. I mean, 30% of the selling price. Yes.
I'm assuming things like handbags are particularly well traded because they're such high fashion items and a lot of people love the classic styles and stuff. So people will buy Gucci, classic Gucci bags from the 60s and 70s, for example, because they've got such character and they've got such history.
Yes, and at the end, you have to remember, fashion is very cyclical. So something will be on trend for a while, then for 10 years, there'll be a different trend, and then that older trend will come back. So it really is cyclical. You see a lot of the older trends coming back, and you also have different trends amongst different generations. So it really gives you a greater access when being able to share, rather than only needing to go with what's currently on trend, which might not speak to you in the new category.
It's a fabulous business idea. Thank you, Michael Zahirif, who is the founder, co-founder of Luxity. Luxury goods at a fraction of the price of the originals. And I've just had so much fun today going through the Luxity website, seeing the physical stores as well, and realizing the sorts of prices people are prepared to pay for stuff brand new. astonishing. Even secondhand, my skate nature doesn't allow me to dabble. But it is a wonderful service in a market where people do like to show off some bling. So if you don't mind utilizing secondhand goods, and you shouldn't really, you'll buy a secondhand car and you should, why would you not get a secondhand watch or a handbag or a nice coat or a jacket? Or that, what on earth is that? There's a lot of really weird stuff on it. Luxity.co. Coming up in a moment, let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz. I won last week because you guys were slow off the mark, and I don't think you should allow me that level of luxury again. I would like to know from you, as of this moment, what is worth more, a euro or a dollar? 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. Give me a call, and let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. Let's see if you can take the title away from me tonight. What's worth more, a euro or a dollar? Right now. 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africa Nacity. APSA is a registered FSB. If you're willing to give it to me again, I'll take it. The title. The title that, you know, is often hard fought for. But tonight you're feeling chicken. Puck, puck. What's worth more, the euro or the dollar? It's a simple enough question. They reached parity for the first time in 20 years this week, where one was worth exactly the same as the other. This evening, one is worth more than the other, very close to parity. Which one is worth more? That is my first question to you this evening, and I'd like you to play. I can't believe that you're sitting on the sidelines of one of the most illustrious contests on earth. I'll put you out of your misery then if you're too chicken to play on a 50-50 basis. The euro this evening is worth a little more than the dollar. 17 rand 26 for a euro, 17.09 for a dollar, practically at parity. That's where we are this evening. Do you know which company used to own Vodacom? Where did Vodacom start? Vodacom, one of the biggest cell phone companies on the African continent. What are the origins of Vodacom? It grew up inside a telecommunications player, which in itself was set back, and it was a disappointing, the holding company was itself a very disappointing player in the telecom space. Well, Vodacom actually came out of Telkom. Alan Knott Craig, the founder of Vodacom, was a Telkom executive, and they went to him, well, why don't you run this thing? And so he did, and did very, very well at it. And then fell terribly ill, of course. Came back after several heart attacks and ran Cell C for a while, and then had a very serious stroke, and I haven't heard about him for a long time. But today, the MTN now wants to buy Telkom. That's the big story. Another big story this week, the International Monetary Fund saying global interest rates are going to have to keep going up until next year, until heated prices begin to cool in response to the actions of central banks. That's the warning from the International Monetary Fund today as well. So those are a couple of the stories that we've been focusing on this week on The Money Show. More on those coming up in the best bits of The Money Show, which comes up after Eyewitness News at 7.